bobbernspeaks.com. Please tune in to Living Consciously, where myself and my co-host will entertain you, inform you, and educate you in certain modalities. Living consciously is something that we really must learn to do, because that way you'll know what's going on around you. This show can be heard at 2 p.m. every Friday on HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Thank you.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Good morning. Discombobulated as usual. 11:01. It is 70 degrees in Flemington, and it is cloudy. Forecast for today is partly sunny, high of 74, which is the opposite of partly cloudy. There's some patchy fog after 2 a.m. this morning. Friday, there'll be patchy fog before 8 a.m., and mostly sunny, high near 83. Friday night, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms after 2 a.m. And Saturday, there's a slight chance of thunderstorms, mainly after 8 a.m. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say these are blowing out to sea.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Good morning, and welcome to the Library Show. Starring Jennifer Winberry and Jip Thatch, broadcasting live over the internet from the Hunterdon County Chamber offices in downtown Flemington, New Jersey. Tune in every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. and get to know the Hunterdon County Library. The library offers a wide array of services, programs, and community support to the residents of Hunterdon County. On today's show, author Scott Decker will be joining us in the studio. The HCL Outdoor Art Show and Sale is this Saturday, June 2nd, weather permitting. Join us at HCL between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. Browse the snow fences on the library lawn and enjoy the work of over 50 local artists. Jennifer's teacher accused her of plagiarism. His words, not hers. Summer reading clubs for kids and adults, our outdoor summer concert series, and much more on today's Library Show. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So Jennifer is playing the Pomp and Circumstance for a specific reason. Jennifer, tell us why.
Why? Because the 2018 Leadership Hunterdon class graduated last night. And I was a member.
Congratulations.
Thank
to you.
You.
It's that very proud event. So what does this mean now to the residents of Hunterdon County that you are a graduate of Leadership Hunterdon? It means something.
It means something. It means that we're ready to, not ready, but we're beginning to be ready to take positions of leadership in the county, to go be members of boards.
Is this the first step for running for political office?
It could be.
Really?
It was for Carolyn Scudder, a friend from the Book Garden, was in Leadership Hunterdon in 2013, the second class. She has since been for public office.
Oh, yeah?
So sure could be.
And do you have aspirations? Is that hat going to be thrown in the ring at some point?
I have aspirations of finishing our paper.
Oh, you still have work to do?
We still have one more class.
Oh. A little premature, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So how was the ceremony?
The
was
date
it
hadn't
nice?
Changed. It was nice. So I wanted to congratulate Jessica and Janet and Jamie and Justin and David and Carolyn and Shauna.
Very good. Nice achievement. Proud of you. Huntington County Library is very proud of you, Jennifer. Okay, before we get to Scott Decker, I just want to mention that we have a big event coming up this Saturday, the HCL Outdoor Art Show and Sale, Saturday, June 2nd, between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. The weather earlier in the week was looking very dicey, but now they're starting to back off of these thunderstorms, Jennifer. The last report I saw was p.m. thunderstorms after the art show is over, so we might be okay. So just keep those positive thoughts coming. So the HCL Outdoor Art Show and Sale, we do this every year. Over 50 local artists will be at the Huntington County Library on Saturday, June 2nd, displaying their finest works on snow fences on the library lawn. The works will be judged. We have two judges, Ken Veith, and I forget the other woman's name, Jennifer. They will be judging. There will be awards. There's going to be cash prizes for best in show, cash prize for public's choice, and then we have three categories, adult professional, adult amateurs, and students, grades 7 through 12. So it's always a very popular event. The artists will be selling their work, so maybe you can stop by and maybe find something to hang in your living room. We'll have music by the Marshall's Dixieland Band, who performed at Community Day last Saturday. They'll be performing with us this Saturday. There's also going to be a kids craft, so if you have a child that's less than 7th grade, we have an Egyptian-themed craft in the meeting room for all our younger county residents. So it's a good day. I suggest coming, maybe bringing a chair. You could bring maybe a picnic lunch and spend some day rubbing elbows with some of our best local artists.
Can you talk about Community Day and how it went?
Yes, actually, the Huntington County 4-H, Community Day, Chamber of Commerce sponsored Community Day was last Saturday at the 4-H Fairgrounds. The weather was threatening then as well, Jennifer, but it held off and actually turned out to be a nice day. So it was a day of food and games and music. Due South performed for the entire day in one of the barns. They were very popular. They're going to be our first concert in our summer concert series outside on July 18th. So save that date. The Huntington County Library Bookmobile was on hand. We had games for teens, like a bean bag toss game for teens, which was popular, and then the ever-popular fish pond full of books for the younger children. And then we were able to promote a lot of our programs and had a basket giveaway for children and adults. But then there were so many other things to do. Bill Brokaw Photography had a photography show on display, 100 in Places it was called. And if you missed it at Community Day, you can stop by the Huntington County Library anytime in June. It's on display in our lobby, the same display that was at Community Day. Also, the Simon & Garfunkel Band Cuckoo Cachoo performed. Marshall's Dixieland Band, as I said, performed. There was lots of food. There were tethered balloon rides. I'm going to forget a lot of things. Petting zoo, reptile show. Just a good family event that they've been doing for 5 years now, Huntington County Community Day.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome, Jennifer.
Or you just kind of ended.
I got to end at some point.
Okay. Well, do you want to go? We'll go to our first commercial
break. Let's go to our first commercial break, and let's get Scott Decker the floor. Author Scott Decker will be telling us all about himself right after these commercial messages.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Huntington County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in a critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Huntington Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Huntington Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
This is Tony Clark, paraplanner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Welcome back to the Library Show. You're in for a treat. Jennifer Winberry is ready for one of her hard-hitting Barbara Walters-style interviews. On the hot seat today is author Skucker. Scott, I hope you have some hankies ready. Jennifer. Like Barbara Walters, she makes guests cry sometimes. Well, Scott?
Usually I do it on the telephone, so I don't know if they're...
Hello. I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming. Marilyn from Twice Told Tales called me last week and said you were going to be in the area, and would we like to have you? Because you're going to be at Twice Told Tales tonight.
Tonight, 7 o'clock, signing books, and there'll be coffee and donuts.
Yeah, Marilyn does nice events.
She's very nice. Yes. Yeah, very nice store.
Yeah. So Scott's the author of the recently published, it was published in March, recounting the anthrax attacks, Amerithrax Tax Force, I'm not reading that, an evaluation of forensics in the FBI. And it won the 2017 Public Safety Writers Association writing competition for an unpublished nonfiction book.
Correct. Thank you.
So how did you come about to write this? Because it's published by Roman and Littlefield,
right,
which is pretty close to an academic publisher. If they think they are, I apologize. But
they have a general interest section, and that's where mine is was published, in the general interest. They do fact-based books, nonfiction. Yeah, they're a large publisher, and they've been great to work with. They really are. They market heavily to libraries.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just not quite as mainstream as...
They're not one of the big five, six in New York that we authors always talk about.
Right. So did you write the book first, or were you approached about writing the book? Or
I wrote the book first. I wrote it in the third person, and I couldn't find anybody interested. And a couple agents that I talked to that were very helpful to me, I did not sign with them, but they were helpful, said, why don't you just write a memoir? It would be much more interesting for people. So I did. I rewrote the whole thing, and then I began having interest from publishers.
Okay, now you're a retired FBI agent. You were a supervisor with the FBI.
Yes.
For
22 years. A combination of both street agent and supervisor agent.
So you were, you retired right after?
I retired in November of 2011.
Okay.
I was close to mandatory. We are mandatory for retirement at age 57.
Okay.
Yeah, I was coming up. I already had my letter from headquarters.
Okay.
Telling me I was leaving.
Did you work mostly out of Virginia, or were you?
Oh no, I started my career in Boston, and if anybody has seen the movie The Town by Ben Affleck, those are fictionalized stories of our cases.
Okay.
The flower shop is there. The two people in the flower shop are real people that are doing life in jail right now, prison.
I did see that movie, yes.
Interesting. Yeah, good movie, good movie. John Hamm did a great job. So I started bank robberies there as a street agent. Great work. A lot of court time. You learn quick, and you turn your cases over very rapidly also. From there, I went down to a new unit at the FBI laboratory based out of Quantico, Virginia, the Hazardous Materials Response Unit. And there I became a supervisor and a team leader. And we would deploy whenever there was an indication of a use of a weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological. It was our job to collect the evidence, preserve it, and get it to a lab where it was safe to analyze. I was at 9/11 on September 12. I brought a team from Quantico. And in November, I went back to the street, Washington Field Office, downtown Northwest D.C., and began working on this new case of people dying from inhalational anthrax.
So you weren't brought in until November, because the first letters started appearing around the 18th of September.
The first indication was October 4th.
Okay.
Where they had diagnosed Robert Stevens in Boca Raton. Now, the way it works, when I was at World Trade, I decided I wanted to do investigations rather than do what we called support work, because as a response unit from Quantico, you would get involved in the beginning of an investigation, but then when everything had settled down, the evidence wasn't collected and preserved, you would move on to another case. And I wanted to see the cases to the end.
Okay.
I wanted to work the investigations again actively. So when I was at the World Trade Center, I typed out a memo we called a step-down memo. I demoted myself back to street agent. It's a GS-13 versus 14. And returned to Quantico. And for about 4 weeks, I was waiting for the transfer unit to cut my orders. So I was answering phones in headquarters, as many people were, because it was right in the aftermath of 9/11. And my the orders came through in November, and I transferred to the field office in Northwest Washington.
Can you talk a little bit about how the process went? Because I know a post office near Trenton was shut down, one of the centers, because they thought a letter had come through there.
We never recovered a letter in Boca Raton.
Okay.
There was the mail room at the office where Robert Stephen worked was very, what we call hot, highly contaminated with anthrax, but we never did recover a letter. The first letter was recovered in Tom Brokaw's office in New York. That was on October 12. And that's when we finally had definitive proof that this was an act of terrorism. We had a handwritten envelope filled with anthrax powder, partially filled. They had opened some of it. We ended up recovering four letters, all logged into evidence. Very early on, we brought United States Postal Inspectors, Postal Service Inspectors, into headquarters and then to Washington Field Office, where we were forming in what we called an ad hoc task force back in October, November of 01. The postal inspectors traced the letters for us. First, they used the postmark, which we can all read, but they also are invisible but visible under blacklight codes on letters when they go through the sorting machines. And they use those codes and the postmark to work backwards. And we identified that the letters had been postmarked in Hamilton, New Jersey, at the large mail distribution center in Mercer County.
Okay, so they all came from there.
All came from the same place, and the postal workers could tell us almost to the minute when they went through the postmark machine.
Wow, that's pretty. That's very specific.
Good lead, yeah, good lead.
Yeah, because my sister's mail was held for months.
A lot of mail was held. Yes. A lot was irradiated before it could be delivered.
Yeah. So how many in all, how many letters were delivered or confirmed? You said four.
Four that we know of. Okay. We suspect there were more, but we did not recover them.
So you've got, when did it start to die down to the point? How long were you on alert looking for these?
When victims were diagnosed, really. We had five people die. The first one was in Boca Raton, Florida. The last one was up in Connecticut, an elderly woman, at the end of November. At that point, with her death, that was the end of any indication there were more letters out there. Nobody else was infected after the end of November of 01.
Okay, so it was over almost as quickly as it started.
It was a rash. There were two different mailings. Okay. We had four letters. They had been mailed on two different dates, two each. in first one in September, and I don't have the date on the top of my head of the second. I believe it was early October. It's in my book. It's all referenced in there. The exact date escapes me right now. But it was September and October of 01. And that appears to be it, just twice. We had the postal inspectors telling us exactly when these letters were postmarked, two different sets, and they worked backwards, and the postal inspectors determined there were a possible of 638 mailboxes in Mercer and Hunterdon County that could have been the point of mailing. I have a map. I give a short talk. With the map, there are three mailboxes in Hunterdon, close to where I grew up, Stockton and Lambertville. It came up that far north. So we had a team of two hazmat-trained FBI agents, along with a New Jersey state trooper, working at night through the summer of 02, and they identified out of 638 one mailbox highly contaminated with anthrax spores, and that was just outside Princeton University campus, 10 Nashua Street.
Okay.
So we now had where they had been dropped from, mailed from.
Would any other mail that had been dropped in that box become contaminated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But then the people receiving it would have to be highly concentrated?
No, it wouldn't have to be. I think we were probably just lucky in that instance. We never identified any non-postal workers that were infected around Mercer County.
Okay.
What did happen, let me back up. The postal inspectors did some real nice forensic work tracing the mail. And what they found, and I did not cite this in the book because I didn't have the full story, but one of the letters that did go through at the same time, not the mailbox, but at the distribution center in Hamilton, ended up in Connecticut and probably cross-contaminated the mail that went to the elderly woman.
Okay.
But as far as that mailbox was concerned, we didn't identify anybody that was sick by cross-contamination there. But it did occur. We believe one death in New York and the one in Connecticut was caused by cross-contaminated mail going through the sorting machines.
Is this the first time that you know of that a biological weapon has been used through the mail?
Through the mail, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And anthrax... Where does one get anthrax?
Anthrax is a disease.
Right. But where would you get the powder to?
Well, anthrax is a disease. It's Greek for coal, because if you get cutaneous anthrax, you have big black lesions on your skin, coal-like. It's caused by a bacteria, and the bacteria is called Bacillus anthracis. Anthracis is actually Greek for coal, or Latin. What happens is anthrax is in nature. If it infects, let's say, a steer in the hot, arid southwest Texas, the steer will die. And as it dies, because the bacteria, anthracis, has populated the body and taken it over, really, it's become septic. When the animal dies, the bacteria is released, but it no longer has nutrition. And now it's subjected to temperatures that it doesn't like. It likes body temperature. And it develops spores as a survival mechanism. It turns into spores which are impervious to light, heat, snow. They will live for years and years in the soil. And what happens as the next generation of steers is grazing and it becomes hot and arid, they'll kick it up and they'll ingest it. And that's how the life cycle works for anthrax. It's also a biological weapon, and it was weaponized in the United States in the 60s. The military produced pounds and pounds and pounds of this stuff, a dry powder, and they had developed it to the point where they could take the spores and make a pure dry mix of spores, which would... I describe it, if you eat oatmeal and you open one of those instant oatmeal packages and pour it in the bowl, you'll see it like a slight cloud just rise up in the kitchen. That's what this stuff does. Okay. It aerosolizes. It becomes a solid that becomes gas-like. And that's where the danger is. And the U.S. program was outlawed, discontinued in 69 by President Nixon. But it was also feared, and rightly so, that other countries, not our friends, would develop this into a weapon and use it on soldiers in Iraq, for instance. And that did it. Iraq did have a big program in this. So anyway, long story short, the U.S. military had developed a vaccine, vaccinated soldiers. I was on the vaccine. But they're also doing a lot of research to develop newer and better vaccines. And it was used in many laboratories in the country for research.
So does the government or the FBI, do you know where the anthrax was stored?
That was how we solved the case.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm a geneticist by training. Before the FBI, I developed DNA diagnostic tests. And the Bureau had a good program in human DNA forensics, what we call DNA fingerprinting. So we took the spores, the anthrax spores, from the envelopes, and we grew it out, and we determined that in a culture, on a petri dish, of the stuff in the envelopes, occasionally there would be a mutated colony. About 10% of the stuff grew oddly after about a week. And each time we regrew it, the odd morphology repeated itself. So that told us whatever was going on was a mutation in the bacteria's DNA. So we had hopes of developing a fingerprint. We did find the mutations. We found 4 mutations in the male spore's DNA. In parallel, my project was to collect the anthrax. The strain of the anthrax was called Ames, A-M-E-S. There were about 100 different strains that we could distinguish by DNA. This was Ames. It was widely used in the research field, and it was one of the most lethal. That's why they used this to test new vaccines. My job was to find all the Ames anthrax in the world. We knew it had been isolated in 1981. That's when its history started. It was isolated from a dead cow in Texas. So we had 20 years of passing this Ames around between researchers, contractors for the military, etc. I ultimately located 16 laboratories in the United States and 4 abroad that had Ames anthrax. We collected all samples of all of those. And out of those 16 plus 4, 20, 21 laboratories, we collected 1,056 samples of different Ames cultures. Over the 21 years, people had experimented, changed, did this and that, and we had over 1,000 of what we considered a separate culture of Ames. We collected those. We took our 4 mutations that were in the male spores, and we compared them. And we found 8 samples out of 1,056 that bore the same DNA mutations as in the envelopes that had killed the people. Those 8 samples all came from one place. That's to answer your question. Long story. But this took us about 3 to 4 years to do.
Okay, and where was the place for anyone who did?
Frederick, Maryland.
Okay.
The United States Army's premier biological research. We call it USAMRID, USAMRIDD, IID, United States Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases. We use the acronym USAMRID. And those 8 samples came from one flask in the possession of a Dr. Bruce Ivins, a civilian Army microbiologist.
And how did he end up at Princeton to mail letters?
We never knew exactly how and when he drove. We had a window for the mailings. The postal inspectors determined whoever mailed it could have done it, I think, a 36-hour window for each of the 2 mailings. We looked at Bruce Ivins' work records, sign-in time cards, essentially handwritten time cards, and he was not present at work during each of those windows for the mailing. Circumstantial, that's the best we ever got. We pulled traffic tickets, traffic violations, parking citations, surveillance films from around the mailbox in Princeton. We never found anything to prove he had been there. But he was missing from work during that time. Okay. And his father was a Princeton University professor, No, let me back up. His father had been a student at Princeton University. He had a strange childhood where his mother was very domineering over his father to the point she would hit the father with objects like wood and frying pan. So he had an odd bringing up and had seen his father really abused emotionally, for sure, by the wife. Dr. Ivins also had a fixation with the sorority Kappa Kappa Gamma. And the mailbox was immediately outside the administration's office of Kappa Kappa Gamma at Princeton University. So circumstantial evidence, but some coincidence that really couldn't be explained otherwise.
I just had a question and it went out of my mind. Oh, golly. I should have written it down. What kind of treatment is there?
The vaccine. Okay. And I was vaccinated when I was in the hazardous material response unit. Fortunately, it's also treatable by antibiotics, penicillin, but the one of choice is called ciprofloxacin. At the time of the mailing, two letters went to Capitol Hill, Senator Tom Daschle and Senator Patrick Leahy. Tom Daschle's letter was opened at the Hart Senate Office Building, and it spread across Capitol Hill. I believe we probably closed 10 to 12 Senate and House of Representative office buildings on the Hill. The exact list is in the end notes of my book. It spread everywhere. It did just what that oatmeal did when the people described in the office what happened. It floated into the air. Some spilled on the floor, others floated into the air. And the ventilation system of the Hart building spread it all over the place. So we closed about 10 to 12 buildings. At the time, our current thinking was that if you were infected, if you breathed this stuff in, antibiotics would not save you. It would be too late. You had to preload in order to be saved. That was our current thinking. That's what we believe. So if you're unvaccinated and all but the military personnel were vaccinated, nobody else in Capitol Hill had ever been vaccinated. There's no need for it. Dr. John Eisholt was the congressional physician to Congress. John was a one-star admiral. He's an unsung hero in this case. He saved hundreds, maybe thousands of lives. And he also taught us about this disease because nobody in the U.S. really had worked with it for 25 years. Right after the Daschle letter was opened, the very next morning, he put out the word across Capitol Hill, show up at my ad hoc clinic in the lobby of one of these buildings, and I will give you antibiotics. It worked. He also sampled the nose of everybody who was in line. He identified probably 100 people with 1,000 over-lethal doses in their nose. So 100 people had breathed in an enormous amount of this stuff, mostly from the Hart office building, but not all. He gave them ciprofloxacin. Everybody survived. And that taught us something about this disease. Antibiotics could save you after the fact, even 8 to 12 hours after the fact. But John, by his quick... And the thinking at the time was controversial, is that doctors shouldn't provide antibiotics to people who don't show symptoms. So what he did was a little groundbreaking, and he took a little bit of a risk professionally, but I credit him with saving hundreds, maybe thousands of lives. And he gave antibiotics to thousands of people over the course of 2 to 3 days. So,
I remembered. Do you think that this would have eventually happened without September 11th? Or did something set it off and he just thought, oh, this is a really good time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We knew from his anthrax lab was highly secure, probably one of the best in the industry around the country at the time. And you have both a magnetic access card to badge your way in on a key reader, and you also had a keypad where you punch in a number. So we had the records of him going in and out of the lab. He started going in his lab late at night in August of 01 and continued in September. When we went back a year or two, he had never worked in the lab like that before, late at night alone. Back then you could be alone. But he started late night work in August of 01. So we believe he started to prepare in August of 01. And as you said, September 11 gave him the opportunity or made him decide to launch his attack.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's why he was doing this to begin with. We suspect the Army was, in 2001, the Army, the Pentagon, was talking about shutting down anthrax research. Biological terrorism was at the height of everybody's mind in the late 90s, somewhat because of Richard Preston's three books, The Hot Zone and The Cobra Event. Even came to President Clinton's attention, those books, and they were bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers. So the country was really poised and worried about biological attacks. I'm sorry, would refresh my...
Would they have happened without, even with 9/11, and you were saying why you thought he, what the impetus was for?
Okay, I had a senior moment there.
when you said the Richard Preston
right.
book, it was leading me down another path.
So. But everybody was, the government and public health was spun up about biological terrorism, and that's why we began the Hazardous Material Response Unit in the FBI. But that's when Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen, William Cohen, mandated every soldier receive anthrax vaccinations. And there may have been some court martials from some people who just wouldn't take it. I don't know for sure. But it was controversial. But it was a mandate, so everybody was vaccinated. Then the guys went to Desert Storm, the first Desert Storm. And they came back with Gulf War Syndrome. And there was an article in Vanity Fair that blamed the vaccine, that blamed Gulf War Syndrome on the vaccine. And this was the vaccine that Bruce Ivins was in charge of developing new and better versions. But he was also tasked with helping production problems in the current vaccine. Well, the Army, the Pentagon looked at this and they began to talk. They said, it's politically causing us a big problem. We're vaccinating thousands and thousands of soldiers. They don't want it. It's been linked to a disease, not proved, but... And then they looked at the likelihood of it being used on the battlefield versus a 500-pound bomb or a radiological event. And I said the likelihood of this happening at a large scale versus the resources we're putting into it aren't paying out. And they were poised to shut down the program and transfer Ivins to a different research project. So we believe his motivation in August of 2001 was to keep anthrax research alive and even bring more funding to the research projects. And it worked. That's exactly what did happen. And then 9/11 gave him the opportunity to hopefully do this anonymously. In the letters, there's a note in each of the letters, and it points to Islam. It says, we hate Israel, we hate the United States, we love Allah. So it appears like he was trying to direct blame to Al-Qaeda. And after 9/11, we were all worried about a second attack. And we worried it very likely would be biological. And Bruce knew this because where he worked was doing a lot of our testing. At the time, we were doing air monitoring for anthrax around D.C. And people at his institution were doing the testing. So he was aware of the rumors and the fear that a biological attack was coming down the road. So, and it worked for about 3 weeks. We did think Al-Qaeda was behind it.
What made you realize that it wasn't?
The profilers down in Quantico did a behavioral assessment of the mailer's personality. And they said it was a male, what we call a lone wolf, a domestic, not a foreigner, and somebody highly skilled in science, obviously. But they said it was a white male. More than likely a white male, a loner. It was not state-sponsored, which is what we would have called an Al-Qaeda attack.
Did you ever get to interview?
Yeah, I've talked to Bruce probably 5 or 6 times during the course of this. I did interview him once because... Even though I was a geneticist, I had grown bacteria. I'd never worked with anthraces, and I certainly didn't know how to make dry spores, wet or dry. And very few people in the country really did. Ivins and his technician were one of the few, And it was a bit of an art. Light and darkness could affect it. The shaking of the cultures in broth could affect it. And when they did the, when they published their methods in the vaccine publications, they left some details out. So if you wanted to learn how to make good anthrax spores, they had to come to you and teach you. Okay. It was a closely held secret, closely held, not classified, but definitely need to know. Obviously, they didn't want it to get out that this is how you make deadly material.
So was he interviewed as part of the investigative process before he was a suspect?
No, at that point, he wasn't high on the suspect list. He was on our list only because of his knowledge.
Okay.
But we didn't have a motive for him. But I wanted to learn how to make spores, and he was one of the best in the country, if not the best. And as I talked to him, he described how he did it, and I equated when he made spores for biological biological weapon mitigation research for the good. He used the same techniques and procedures that we would use in biological attacks, and I made that. I pointed that out to him, and he got extremely mad. And to that point, he was very mild, friendly, helpful type of guy. But he just snapped. His personality did a 180, and I didn't know if he was going to come after me or not. But I realized that I had said something insensitive, but he shouldn't have reacted like that. There was no call for him to be irate. And at that point, I thought something was a little odd here. And he also kept trying to blame other people, his coworkers. So there were FBI agents roaming the halls of USAMRID, again, trying to get a grip on the anthrax research world, which we didn't know much, if anything, about. Every time an FBI agent would walk down the hall past him, he would approach them and what we call dime somebody else out. He kept saying, this person did it, this person did it. One coworker who made vaccines with him had moved to New Jersey, right by where their mailbox, not far from the mailbox. Well, he also knew where this person's mother lived in New Jersey. Why? Why would you even care, Bruce? But he had this habit of continually trying to feed us and from being way too helpful to a detective, an investigator that kind of sets off an alarm. What is going on here? So we had this kind of stuff going on with him. Then we got the genetic match to his material, his research spores, and that's when we realized that he very likely had done this, and we just needed to prove it.
When he was finally arrested or taken into custody, did he gloat, or was he?
No, he was never arrested. He was never detained. What we call that's when you keep somebody, they're not under arrest, but they know they're not going to leave. That was never done. He was interviewed several times, twice in the beginning of 08. They were confrontational interviews. They were very harsh. It was laid on the table that we know you did this. You just ought to tell us and accept responsibility. He could never explain adequately why he was in his laboratory late at night in August and September of 01. And I didn't mention, three nights in a row, hours, late in the middle of the night before each of the two mailings. So that was a definite pattern. Three long nights alone before each of the mailings. Again, circumstantial, but that definitely pointed towards him. In the interviews that got in his face, I did not do them. A couple of my counterparts did. He gave some stories, but then in the second interview, what you'll find as a detective, a good detective, any detective will tell you this, when people lie and then you re-interview them 2 or 3 months later, they don't tell you the exact same story because they made it up, and it's very hard to remember. If they're telling you the truth and they live those events, it's easy to remember them usually. I mean, you might get a couple things wrong, but when they're lying and you give the different story a second time, it's because you can't remember your lie. You don't write it down. That's what was going on. He had an attorney for those two interviews. They were confrontational, but he wasn't arrested. We were still trying to build a case, examining his emails. He did admit to the obsession with the sorority, and the statute of limitations had passed. It was over, I think local would be 7 years probably. It was over 7 years ago, but he admitted stalking sorority sisters. He had admitted vandalizing, burglarizing sorority houses when they were empty, when nobody was around. He had stolen things from the sororities, a ritual book. I'm not a fraternity member, but I guess that's what's used in Greek societies, college societies, organizations, rather. He admitted vandalizing a sorority sister near Frederick, Maryland, vandalizing her car and her property, her house. And he freely admitted this, and he admitted it was an obsession, not a hobby, an obsession. He'd carried this for over 20 years because he had been jilted by a sorority sister in college, and he never got over it. He stole laboratory notebooks when he was in graduate school from somebody that had been in the sorority and then mailed them back anonymously. He also, I'm jumping ahead. That was where we were. He was called in again with his attorney and given one more chance for an interview, what we call a proffer, where if he tells the truth, it won't be used against him. But he can try to convince the government he's innocent. One last shot. The government also gets a look at what the potential defense case is going to be. So it's information sharing from each side, but it can't be used as evidence. His attorney agreed to it. He came in I believe, June of 08, gave the proffer. It went very poorly. He could not tell us why he had been in the labs late at night. He contradicted earlier statements from January and February of that year. He finally shut down. He just stopped answering questions. It was going so poorly for him. They left. His attorney told him to inspect a federal indictment and to expect the government to ask for the death penalty. There is that provision in this type of case. We had him under surveillance, 24-hour surveillance at that point. We were hoping he would lead us to a hidden collection of past evidence, something he kept as a souvenir, something like that. What did happen is in July, around 1 o'clock in the morning, agents and postal workers were out in the neighborhood on the street watching his house, and they knew he was in the house. An ambulance showed up in a police car, and he was wheeled out on a gurney, unconscious. Once at the hospital, it was found that he had taken large amounts of Tylenol mixed with Valium, as the metabolites were in his blood and urine when they did the tests. And Tylenol poisoning is one of the most common in the country, at the poison centers around the country. It's very painful because it destroys the liver. Tylenol in large amounts will destroy your liver. Once the liver goes, then the other organs, kidney and heart, go, and your blood becomes septic. Bacteria build up in your blood, and you last about 2 days. It's very painful, so we think the idea of the Valium is it kept him asleep for the early stages of the onset of the poisoning so that he could not seek an antidote. There is an antidote. He did briefly wake up in the hospital. He admitted to a nurse he tried to commit suicide. He had a living will. His wife had a living will, and his wife, after about 48 hours, ordered there would be no attempt at an organ transplant, disconnect life support, and he died by suicide. It was ruled suicide. We never had the chance to indict him or take him before a judge.
His wife, did he have children?
He had two adopted children, a son and daughter.
And have they pretty much just faded off into the sunset and tried to dis...
Yeah.
But did they... They stuck with him through the...
Yes, yeah.
And was the wife ever interviewed, or what did you know?
I never interviewed the children or the wife for my book. I relied on a book by David Willman. It's called The Mirage Man. Mirage Man. I'm in the book. Several of my other agent partners are in the book. David's a reporter for the L.A. Times. He lives up in Rockville, Maryland. He's won a Pulitzer for reporting, and he's a good reporter. He did interview the kids. I think the wife refused, but he did interview the children. I relied on his book for my... I did not want to do that, so I left them alone. But for all I could tell, the children loved him, and he loved them.
So the wife wasn't brought in during the investigation process, as far as you know?
No.
Like, where was your husband?
The task force, the Mirathrax task force, may have talked to her, but I don't know.
Okay.
I never saw any interview report. if they did.
Aside from the stalking of the sorority women, was there anything else in his past?
The HIPAA, H-I-P-A-A, Act was passed in the mid-90s, maybe? I don't have the date. Again, it's in my book. It's an endnote. But the HIPAA prevented what I used to do in the early 80s. I could go to Mass General Hospital in Boston and subpoena medical records from a bank robber who had injuries. We wanted to know what caused the injuries because we're looking at conspirators. So that was easy to do. The HIPAA Act was passed, and that's a protection act for insurance and medical information. I could no longer do that. And you couldn't just go get mental health records. But we knew he had been seeing two or three psychiatrists. And after he committed suicide, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., succeeded in getting access to his mental health records. A judge gave them an order that waived HIPAA. Turns out the first psychiatrist he had been seeing in the 70s and then the 80s and into the 90s, there were reports there which corroborated the vandalism, the stalking, the obsession with the sorority sisters. But he also was obsessed with a former technician who transferred to medical school in Ithaca. Emails her constantly. He had another obsession with her. He told the psychiatrist that he was mad at her because of she wasn't answering his email correctly, etc. He was going to poison a bottle of wine. He was going to drive from Frederick, Maryland up to Ithaca, New York, give her the wine, and then return home. Right there, we had a pattern of long night drives for odd reasons. I remember he went to Princeton from Frederick, about a four-hour round-trip drive. That established a pattern, but it also showed that he was homicidal. He had told the psychiatrist this. She said, "Bruce, that's not a good idea. I don't want you to do that." He came back 2 weeks later and said, "Well, I did it." She was annoyed. She had called the police, but she didn't have a victim name, so nothing could be done. He said, "I did it. I poisoned the wine, and I drove to Ithaca. We talked, and I made a visit. But at the last minute, I took the wine back home with me. I didn't give it to her." So he had things like that in his past, which definitely showed tendencies for homicide and not a stable mind. Yeah, he was on a lot of drugs. It's like Lunesta, Valium, Ambien. He drank a lot of alcohol, vodka bottles in his trash. It appeared to me that as these male, he was just getting worse. He thought, and we knew this from the psychiatry notes and some emails, he thought he was predisposed from schizophrenia, and he believed his mother had gotten schizophrenia late in her life. And it looks like he was sliding down that path as he went through his 50s into his 60s.
Okay. Getting close to the end of the hour. Did you have any questions?
No, I'm just fascinated. I could listen to you for hours.
Well, you can tonight. You can go to
Twice
Told Tales.
Well, there's
a book. You go to Twice Told Tales on Bloomfield Avenue
tonight.
Well,
how can we get his book? How can we get your book, Scott?
Go to Twice Told Tales tonight.
Tonight? Or Maryland. Is it online somewhere? Someone was listening wanted to buy your book?
Amazon is carrying it. If you go to Roman and Littlefield, I think a 30% coupon is still in effect. Certainly it's available through Amazon. And excerpts are available on Amazon as a, what they call it, first read. I think the first two chapters. And they do change that occasionally. But Goodreads also has some of it where you can read there too. I would say come over to Maryland's bookstore. It's one of the nicest, well-organized bookstores I've been in.
Yeah,
she really does a nice job.
Yes, and she does really nice author events.
And we're going to have Starbucks coffee.
Nice. I neglected to mention at the beginning, you're born and bred Hunterdon County.
I am from Kingwood.
Yes.
Barbertown. I graduated from Delaware Valley Regional High School in 72.
You don't have to say. You don't have to say what year.
Yeah, I'm getting on in years. Yeah, 72. And we've put the farmland is in Barbertown. I was able to put, my mother and I put 60 acres in the farmland preservation with the help of the Hunterdon Land Trust.
Okay.
Patricia Ruby up at DeVore Farm, who I just met with yesterday, were very helpful. And it's part of the Lockatong Creek Preservation. They don't have signs up yet, but the Lacatong does go through our farmland. And, yeah, they do nice work there. And then I moved away to go to college and just came. I did work at the Riegel Paper Mill, which I understand just got approval to be demolished, the Superfund approval in Milford.
That would be great if it got cleaned up.
But I spent some my youth there in what became one of the worst Superfund sites in New Jersey.
Indeed. Well, we're really glad you took some time out this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Very honored to be here.
So everybody should come to Twice Told Tales tonight. They're on Bloomfield Avenue. You'll be there at 7 o'clock. And Jim Gonneau is out in the hallway. And we apologize to all our advertisers that we glossed over today. We will give you full vent next week. So thanks for listening. Remember, wherever you are, you can call, go online, or stop in. Your library is always there for you.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
Chinese government officials say they've been investigating at least two cases where U.S. diplomats working in China have fallen ill with mysterious symptoms, but they have no idea what's causing them. That, as the U.S. State Department does say, several Americans have been suffering from symptoms very similar to what State Department personnel in Cuba suffered in the past, cases which have also gone unsolved. The Washington Post says in one case, an American who's been working in China claims to have heard strange noises while also showing several other symptoms of brain injury. President Trump is going to be meeting at the White House this afternoon with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The two men then expected to have a joint news conference. The North Korean summit expected to be at the top of the agenda. President Trump tomorrow heads to the G7 summit in Canada, and then he'll be heading to Singapore for that summit with Kim Jong-un. And this is USA Radio News.
I'm Chris Walls, and I'm a truck driver from Missouri. For 13 hours a night, I sit in my truck and I drive. Out of boredom, I'll stop and eat. If I'm not doing fast food, I guarantee there's a bag of chips open on my dashboard. That was all until Andro 400. I started out 4 months ago, and since taking Andro 400, I have dropped 45 pounds. I'm sleeping better. There's no cravings. I actually don't even think about food. My knee pain went away. I've had some lower back issues, and I've noticed that that went away, and I can only contribute that to Andro 400. One thing that Andro 400 said on the radio ad, says it attacks belly fat. Well, let me tell you, it did. The second month is where I saw a drastic change in the size of my stomach. I've lost 6 inches. This product really does work.
So guys, if you'd like to experience similar results, then get Andro 400, the safe, natural, and inexpensive way to boost your testosterone. Go to andro400.com or call 888-400-0435, 888-400-0435.
Russia's president discusses the possibility of a World War III in his annual TV phone-in show. Vladimir Putin warning that a large-scale global war would lead to the end of the world. Putin delivering the warning during that show when a caller asked him whether economic sanctions could set off a World War III. Putin quoted Albert Einstein saying he doesn't know what weapons will be used in a World War III, but if there is one, he says a World War IV would be fought with sticks and stones. House Republicans are hoping to come up with a compromise today on immigration, hoping to put together a bill that would satisfy conservatives who want to crack down on illegal immigrants, but also moderates who want to protect young people brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Officials from West Virginia and southern Pennsylvania are watching a gas pipeline closely after an explosion sent a big fireball into the air early this morning in Marshall County, West Virginia. This is USA Radio News.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Are drug and alcohol problems hitting you too close to home? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. 866-490-3991. 866-490-3991. That's 866-490-3991.